Hebrews chapter 11, 1-6 will hopefully complement it, because faith is such a key ingredient in this story. I don't know if you've heard the story of the bishop who was with his wife in the car, and they were driving down the road and they suddenly ran out of petrol. And the bishop's wife said, "Well, don't worry, darling, there's a garage about half a mile down the road." So he got out of the car and he opened up the boot and he looked for a container to put petrol in. But all he could find was the grandson's potty. Well, needs must, it will have to do. So off he walked to the local garage and returned very carefully carrying this potty full of petrol. Well, he stood at the side of his car, he opened up the petrol tank and very carefully started to pour the contents of the potty into the petrol tank. Just then, one of the leaders from one of the evangelical churches drove by, saw a fellow Christian in need, and decided to pull over and help. As he saw him pouring the contents of the potty into the petrol tank, he said, "If I'd known you'd have faith like that in the Church of England, I'd never have left." Well, faith is a key ingredient in this story. What is faith? It is simply taking God at his word. There's nothing new about it. And Hebrews 11 demonstrates that. Every generation God speaks. And in every generation, some, not all, respond by obeying. I suppose there are two sides to faith. Saving faith and experimental faith. Saving faith is primary. That's what fits us to heaven. Experimental faith is secondary. That's what fits us for earth. Saving faith is intangible. It can't be measured. When you became a Christian, some of you had great faith. Some of you had faith as small as a mustard seed. We couldn't see it. It was something invisible, inward. It's intangible. You can't measure saving faith. On the other hand, experimental faith is tangible. It produces results. We know Abraham's faith because he offered up his son. There is visual evidence. We know Noah had faith because he built an ark. There is visual evidence. So saving faith comes first. That's what equips us for heaven. And then experimental faith, we live or we walk by faith. Saving faith is a persuasion of the heart and the mind. It occurs at that moment when we realise we cannot save ourselves. And literally put all of our eggs in one basket and we say, "I am trusting in the finished work of Jesus for my salvation. Not my works, not my good deeds, not my church attendance. It is simply faith in the death and the resurrection of Jesus." Experimental faith lies in the will. It is active. God speaks to us in his word, and we seek, with the power and the enabling of the Holy Spirit, to obey. And we're going to see this morning that Joshua and Caleb had that experimental faith. They visually put their belief into action. Whereas the rest of the nation, 2 million people, did not. Only two out of an approximately 2 million people exercised real faith. The background, as we saw in the DVD clip, is when Moses and the Hebrew people arrive at Kadesh Barnea. That is the last oasis in the Negev desert. You can still visit it today. It's about 66 miles southwest of the Dead Sea. It has taken them, now this is an 11-day journey by foot, if you want to do it today. It took these people 1 year, 1 month, and 1 week since they left Egypt to arrive at this point. And over the past few weeks, you've looked at why they had detours, why they went the long way, why it's taken 1 year, 1 month, 1 week for them to arrive at this point. But here's the point. They now have the opportunity to enter the promised land. It is there in front of them. It is so close they can probably smell it. It is so close they can see it. They can almost touch it. But will they occupy it? Are they going to enjoy it? Have they got the faith to believe? Well, verse 1 of chapter 13 tells us that God tells them to send out 12 spies, one from each of the tribes of Israel. In military terms, the people are going to do a reconnaissance. They're going to check the area to see what's there, so that when they do invade, they can invade, well, using a military strategy. They know what they're up against. And as a wise leader, Moses knows if they're going to inhabit this land, they need to know what the land is like. If you scan down to verse 18 and 19, he asks a number of questions. Is the soil fertile or poor? Are the trees in the land or not? He wants to know what they're going into. He even requests they bring some fruit back for them to taste and enjoy. Are the people there many or few? Are they weak or strong? Do they dwell in tents or fortified cities? Any wise leader that is about to invade another country needs to do their homework. They need to know what situation they're going into. Verse 21 to 23 tells us exactly where the spies went exploring. Verse 25 tells us that their explorations lasted 40 days. And if you want to know who the 12 spies were, well, verses 4 to 16 gives them a name check. And our two heroes, Joshua and Caleb, are name checked in verse 6, 8 and 16. So that's the background. They're at the promised land. There's a great opportunity for them to seize. They've done their reconnaissance. They've looked at the land. They know what it's all about. What's the next step? Surely it's to claim it. Or is it? I want to divide the passage up into five headings. Number one, their opportunity, special. Their opportunity, special. In the days before modern harbours, if a ship wanted to make it into port, it had to wait for the flood tide to carry it in. It needed that flood tide to carry it in. And they had a Latin term for a ship waiting for the flood to bring it into port. The Latin term was two words, ob and porto. Ob, porto. It literally meant off port. Off port. We get our English word opportunity, off porto, from those two words. The captain waiting for that tide so that they can sail in. If they miss it, the opportunity's gone. They've got to wait for the next one. Shakespeare, in one of his plays, Julius Caesar, Act 4, Scene 3, takes that original meaning and uses it. Let me quote. He says, "There is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Admitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries. On such a full sea, we are now afloat, and we must take the current when it serves, or lose our ventures." Opportunity, off port, waiting. You'd seize the moment, or it's gone, and you might not have it again. These Hebrew Christians have a special opportunity. The opportunity to enter the promised land. But will they take it? Notice in verse 26, the spies bring back a report to Moses and to the rest of the people. The land is fertile. And they describe it flowing with milk and honey. Well, what's the big surprise? Isn't that what God told them? And God always keeps his word. And if you want evidence of what the land is like, I love verse 23. They bring back this cluster of grapes. Just one cluster. And they have to bring it on a pole, on a branch. And two people have to carry it. You get the impression the grapes are the size of watermelons, don't you? And just think, if that's the size of the grapes, what are the pomegranates and the figs like? You know, incredible. And the Hebrews now have the opportunity they've been waiting for. They can occupy the land. Just think, way back to the time of Abraham, this was promised them. And this special opportunity is for this generation, if they want it. Yeah, it's been delayed, but there it is, right in front of them. Surely nothing could hinder them. Well, notice their outcome, small. Verse 25, their outlook, small. At the end of 40 days, the spies return from their mission. And they start to report what they saw. Verse 26. They presented themselves before Moses and Aaron and the whole congregation of the people in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They reported to the whole congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Then they told them the story of their trip. "We went to the land to which you sent us, and oh, it does flow with milk and honey. Just look at this fruit. The only thing is..." Now they start in verse 28 to go past their assignment. Verse 27 is what they were told to report on. Had they stopped there, that would have been good. But in verse 28, they go beyond what was asked. They were asked just to report about the land. Does it flow with milk and honey? And they do that in verse 27. But in verse 28, they go beyond their remit. And they give out news that is going to affect the people in only one way. In a negative way. The only thing is. About 350 years ago, a shipload of travellers landed on the northeast coast of America. Settlers to a brand new continent. The first year they established a town site. The next year they elected a town government. The third year the town government planned a road 5 miles into untrained territory. In the fourth year, the people impeached their government because they said, "This road is going nowhere. It is a waste of public funds. To build a road 5 miles westward into a wilderness was pointless. Who needs to go there?" And the point of the illustration is this. These people had travelled 3,000 miles across an ocean. They had overcome incredible hardships to get there. But in just a few years, they were unable to see more than 5 miles ahead of them. They'd gone 3,000 miles to a new continent. But they couldn't see just down the end of the road the potential that was there. Sadly, these Hebrew Christians were like that. They've gone from slavery to freedom. They've arrived at the promised land. They've been on an incredible journey. There's only one more step to make. But they haven't got the faith to make it. Look at verse 28. "The only thing is that the people who live there are fierce. Their cities are huge and well fortified. But worse yet..." That's not depressed you. "Worse yet, we saw the descendants of giant Anak. Anakites are spread out in the Negev. Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites hold the hill country. And the Canaanites and the Termites..." Sorry, I put that one in just to see if you were awake. "are established on the Mediterranean Sea along the Jordan." Wow. Take your eyes off the fruit and the land of honey and milk. Look at all the negatives, all the problems, all the enemies. "Both the hummingbird and the vulture fly over deserts. All a vulture sees is rotten meat, because that's all a vulture looks for. They thrive on that diet of dead meat. The hummingbirds ignore the smelly flesh of dead animals. Instead, they look for the colourful blossoms of desert plants." I guess the point is this. The vultures live on what was. They live on the past. They fill themselves with that which is dead and gone. The hummingbirds live on what is. They seek new life. They fill themselves with freshness and life. Each bird finds exactly what it's looking for. Hey, their outlook was small because they looked at the negative, not the positive. They walk by sight and not by faith. And how easy as Christians we can do the same. Thirdly, their opposition strong. Look at verse 31. "The men who had gone up with him said, 'We can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are.' And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. They said, 'The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. The descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. We seem like grasshoppers in our own eyes. And we look the same to them.'" I guess if you've got a small view of God, you're always going to have a large view of your enemies. Notice what they said. "The people who dwell there are strong." giants in stature. I suppose any attempt at doing God's will, moving forward in your faith, is going to meet with resistance, with opposition somewhere. Charles F. Kettering said this: when I was research head of General Motors and wanted a problem solved, I placed a table outside of the board meeting room. It had a sign on it: leave your slide rules here. If I didn't do that, I'd find someone reaching for his slide rule in the meeting, standing on his feet, and then saying, "Boss, you can't do it. You can't do it." Any attempt at doing God's will, the impossible, will always meet with resistance. Just look how quickly the lack of vision and faith spread among the Hebrew people. Check out verses 1 to 3 of chapter 14. After the Israelites heard the report from the 12 men who had explored Canaan, the people said, "Let's conquer." No, they didn't. They cried all night. They wept. Verse 2. They said, "We're right behind you, Moses. You lead, we'll follow." No, they didn't. And complained to Moses and Aaron. The middle of verse 2. "We're sure looking forward to those grapes and those figs and that time in the promised land." No, we'd wish we'd died in Egypt or somewhere here in the desert. And verse 3. "We've got a mighty God, and a mighty God does mighty things." No, they don't. Verse 3. "Is the Lord leading us into Canaan just to kill us and have our women captured? We were better off in Egypt." And what an exaggeration. Talk about playing on people's emotions and pulling the heartstrings. Think of the poor women. They're going to end up captive slaves. Verse 4. "Hey, we're ready to choose another leader and head back to Egypt. We want to stay with the familiar. We want to play safe. We want to walk by sight and not by faith." There's an antelope called the African Impala. It can jump to a height of 10 feet and cover a distance of over 30 feet. It's quite an impressive creature. And yet those magnificent animals are kept in zoos by a 3-foot wall. Even though they can jump 10 feet, even though they can jump 30 feet, a 3-foot wall imprisons them. Because the African Impala will not jump where it can't see it might land. It can't jump in faith. If it can't see where it's going to land, it won't take the risk. And these people are the same, aren't they? They can't trust God, the one who has led them to this point. They compare the giants to themselves, and they're a defeated bunch. Apart from two, Joshua and Caleb, who are going to be victorious. These two men realize that with God, one man, or two men in this case, are always a majority. They have a great big God. They're expecting great big things. They're walking by faith, not by sight. So the third bit, they're talking about Joshua and Caleb's omnipotence, was sovereign. Look at verse 30. "Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, 'We should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it.'" There's no doubt there, is there? We can certainly do it. Two men out of 2 million marched to the beat of a different drum. Men of faith and vision. Why? Because their eyes weren't fixed on the obstacles. Their eyes were fixed on God. Did Joshua and Caleb see the same people that the other 10 spies saw? Well, yes, they did. They may be giants, humanly speaking, but they're only dwarfs to a great big God. And in chapter 14 and verse 6 to 8, look at the vision of these men. Verse 6 of chapter 14, "Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were among the scouts who had searched the land, rent their clothes. And they said to all the company of Israelites, 'The land through which we passed as scouts is exceedingly good land.'" And don't miss verse 8. "If the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us in this land and give it to us." What a difference between their outlook and the other 10 spies. He will bring it. He will give us. It's the Lord. They are God-focused. Not self-confident, but confident in God. Someone has said, we must never leave God out of the equation. If you feel like a grasshopper and your opposition looks like giants, then your God is too small. God is an all-powerful God. And if he leads us, if he wills us to do something, there is nothing that can hinder it from happening if we stay faithful to him. Their omnipotence, sovereign. And then finally, the Hebrew people, their outcome, sad. Out of 2 million people, only two had faith to believe. The rest doubted and failed miserably. And the result of their faithless outlook, God swore not one person from that generation would enter the promised land except the two men of faith, Joshua and Caleb. It's interesting, for every day the spies spied out the land, 40 days, God said, you'll be one day per year out in the wilderness. 40 years wandering before that opportunity would come again. And two exceptions, of course, to that punishment, Joshua and Caleb. Two who believed and trusted God. And as a result of their faith, experienced firsthand the promises of God. I love the story of Sir Christopher Wren, who at one time was supervising the construction of a massive cathedral. And as he walked round with a journalist, the journalist stopped and started asking the workers different questions. He saw a stonemason and said, what are you doing? And the stonemason said, I'm chipping away at this stone, I'm shaping a stone. He saw a carpenter, he said, what are you doing? He said, I'm carving this wood. And he saw a labourer pushing a wheelbarrow. What are you doing? He said, sir, I am building a cathedral. He saw the bigger picture. And out of 2 million people, only two saw the bigger picture. God is in our side. He has promised us the land. He will give us the victory. So I guess finally we're back to where we started, aren't we? What is faith? It's simply taking God at his word. I trust we all have saving faith. We've all put our eggs in one basket. We are trusting in the death and the resurrection of Jesus to take us to glory. We're saved by faith, but the Bible says we are called to walk by faith. Tangible, to put our faith into action, to trust in through the difficulties of life. When those giants come our way, God is always bigger. But victory relies not in our self-confidence, but in the Lord, as we keep on trusting. So their opportunity was special. God gives us special opportunities. He may give you an opportunity I will never see. He'll give me opportunities you will know nothing about. Do we take them, or do we pass them by? Their outlook was small. Our outlook will always be small unless we're focused on a great big God. A focus on a great big God doesn't happen instantly. It comes out of a regular life discipline as we spend time with him day by day. The opposition was strong. We've got lots of enemies in life. The world, the devil, our sinful nature, to name but a few. But God is stronger. There, Joshua and Caleb's omnipotence was sovereign. With God's help, we can be victorious. Without God, the outcome is always sad. May we walk by faith and not by sight. Let's pray.